Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone. Josh here with Orlando Entrepreneurs. This is a show where I travel around, I talk with great entrepreneurs who are building incredible businesses and those who support the entrepreneurial community. On today's show, I'm going to bring up some topics with one of our guests that you guys are going to love. And we're going to talk about selling your business and evaluating your business and all the things that are the exciting part of that journey. So on today's show, I have the CEO and founder of Contango Investments, Mr. George Rosen. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Josh. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Contango Investments and what you guys do.
Certainly. We are a business brokerage firm focused on helping small business owners get into and out of ownership of a business. We target those successful companies that are revenue bases between that $800,000 range and $5 million.
Got it. So your sweet spot that you guys have found is between $800,000 and about $5 million. Interesting. Why did you choose that range?
Well, if you study the evolution of an entrepreneurial business, there's the startup entity where the revenues are typically in that 100,000 upwards of 800,000, and that is survival mode. Anything for a buck, trying to be all things to all people just to keep the lights on. As the company matures and gets past that initial stage, business owners reach a certain level of success where at $800,000, they're not just taking an existence out of the business, they have employees typically at that level, and they're starting to leverage their resources. And that's when a business entity is really a going concern. And our skill set is helping that business owner convert their equity in that small business into cash to take out and invest in an alternative investment vehicle or retire. And as the companies get larger and larger, we see they're taking on additional employees and middle management and putting additional processes in place, because under 800,000, the business owner typically has to address every single decision. When he gets to that certain successful stage that now he has people and processes empowered, he doesn't have to stop operations, turn around and answer a question, make a decision. So that's where we focus on the larger small businesses. And once a company is north of about $5 million, not always, but they typically have the skill set in-house to do what we would do, which is make that business operation transparent so a buyer can answer that question, what would I get for my money?
See, I think that's pretty interesting. So you've been doing this for how long altogether?
25 years in business sales, and for 3 years prior to that, I was operating as what we call a tenant representative in leasing restaurant space mainly. And before that, I was a restaurateur and nightclub operator.
Okay, so you started, why don't you tell us about how you became an entrepreneur yourself? Talk to us a little bit about your history, and then I'm going to ask you more questions about your business, because I know the audience right now has a lot of questions on their head about their business, and I know you have the answers to it. But let's start with you.
I started out in Hawaii while going to school. I studied under an entrepreneur who had a fantastic business mind. His name was John Boussalis. He was a Greek gentleman who came to Hawaii with a license to open up 10 restaurants. And there were two different brands. One was Chi-Chi's Mexican restaurants. This was an old chain, some of the old timers may recall. The other one was Tony Roma's. And John did something that I thought was brilliant. He would take down a larger parcel of real estate where if he couldn't afford to go onto Restaurant Row and buy 3 acres and build two separate restaurants, he could go across the street where the land cost was less. And because he could take down a bigger footprint of property, he made himself a miniature restaurant road to where he could drive traffic, gain the advantages of the economy of scales for cross-easement parking, have fantastic ingress and egress. And because he was co-branding with complementary brands, it didn't overlap too much, he created his own buzz. So when I was working for John, he took me under his wing and showed me a lot about what makes a location successful. And I was always interested in understanding the why this location versus that location. And as a young 18, 19-year-old kitchen manager, when we were looking at scouting new locations, I remember he'd take me and put me on a street corner with a clicker. And I was doing demographic car counts at different day parts to figure out, is this a location that he wants a restaurant? So I was always fascinated with the demography and with patterns. Why is this a better business model than that one?
So you kind of started your entrepreneurial journey as a car counter on the corner doing demographic research and learning the flow of traffic. And I think that's pretty important because you were sharing, like, he created his own buzz. But that's kind of how you got your start, by being mentored by someone who did it really, really well.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So while you're sitting there on the corner with the high-tech clicker and you're counting cars going through, what was going through your head as an early employee, early person in your career? Like, what was going through your head? What were you learning then?
I was trying to see the patterns for, if we put a restaurant in this location, do the demographic support based on the day part, when you've got the going to work side of the road versus the coming home side of the road? Are your customers probably going to go home first, pick up the wife and kids and come back out to eat? Or are they going to stop in at happy hour on the way home? And trying to figure out, who's our customer? What do we have to do to get noticed by our customers? And that was always the fun part, was trying to outsmart the market to be the early adopter for why we'd want in this location versus across town paying much higher rent.
Awesome. So he did something brilliant, is he created his own buzz by putting these restaurants together, like you were saying, economies of scale. And as you grew into that role and worked with this man, like, what was your next step in your journey, and what other things did you learn along your journey?
That is a great question. And more than anything else, organizational development. What I mean by that is, when I was first hired, it was as a busboy. And I couldn't become a waiter until I became the lead busboy and actually trained three separate classes of busboys. So we had new locations that we were targeting, and we had to build from within our talent pool. And nobody starts out in life thinking, I want to be a great busboy. But it's a stepping stone. And when you see an organization that really has that growth path, you find good talent. People want to be part of that exciting growth. They want to be part of an organization which is progressive and is offering something in addition to a paycheck. It's an opportunity to learn additional skills and grow as a professional and a business person. So I went from thinking like a busboy to thinking like a business owner, even though I was originally hourly before I transitioned into management. But that was because John would seek out people that he thought had that fire in their belly and wanted to learn more, wanted to take on more responsibilities. And that was fun. As a kid, that was always exciting.
That's awesome. And that's great. That's great mentorship. That's great. You know, he's building leaders. So from there, you wound up becoming a restaurateur. What was the word for it? Were you a restaurateur?
A restaurateur. Yes, a restaurateur. And actually, okay. Hawaii was much too expensive, even on a kitchen manager's salary. I moved down to Miami. I had a sick, ailing grandmother down there who had a broken hip. When I first got to Miami, I took a position in Miami-Dade Community College teaching accounting while waiting tables at night, looking for my next big opportunity without a whole lot of money to work with. It was looking for vehicles. In 1989, Grandma was all better by then, I saw Orlando as the real estate boom market. So I relocated from South Florida up to Orlando, which was really an exciting growth town. and I wanted to be where the action was. And that's another lesson I learned was, if you stay a small fish in a small pond, you're not going to get to that next step. You've got to get where the action is and chase it and really put yourself out there and get out of your comfort zone. And that's not easy, but it's fun and exciting. And you make a lot of stumbles along the way, but that's part of what growth and professionalism and business entrepreneurialism is all about.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I mean, you've been in the business for a really long time, and you've seen a lot of businesses' success and failures. Talk to us more about how you went from, you know, washing dishes to one day becoming a restaurateur to switching over to the side of helping people sell their businesses. What did that look like? And then I've got some really incredible questions to ask. Like, I'm so excited about these.
Okay. Well, the first offing as a restaurateur in an ownership position was taking over a failing nightclub chain with five units called Studebaker's. And this was five units collectively grossing $10 million but losing money. And I was tapped to figure out the operations, find out why we're losing money, and fix it. Now, we did use bankruptcy protection as a method of reorganization. So we went through a Chapter 11 reorganization. We took the best talent from the various locations, brought them over to the best locations, and got rid of the underperforming stores that were either worn out or the demographics had changed around it, or it just had been there too long and didn't have that ability to turn it around. With the three nightclubs that we then took back out of bankruptcy, we now had three units grossing $10.5 million. And it was more than anything else, not just getting the expense structures right and renegotiating the leases, it was getting the right people that wanted to be there, that wanted to have fun and do the corporate mission, which was service our customers and do it in an exciting fashion that the customers wanted to come out and be there. We took stores that were doing $2 million and on an annualized run rate, quickly grew them into $3.5, $4 million stores. And it was really just getting the people who liked doing what they were doing, and the customers ate it up.
I had no clue that you were in the nightclub business. That's pretty exciting. You must have learned a lot of street smarts being in that business. I mean, I've always been on the other side of the counter, but you learn a lot when you're in that environment for that kind of time. What are some street smarts you learned while being in the bar business and the nightclub business?
You do get a little thick-skinned, and one of my colleagues used the term, you've got some bark on you. And when you've been in that business long enough, you get some bark on you, and you're not shocked when you see a case of steaks going out the back door. You have to make difficult choices and fire people you thought were your friends, but that's the restaurant business the world over. So the downside is, in the bar business, you're there before people come out to have a good time, so you're setting up. You're there while they're having fun and serving them. And then afterwards, you're cleaning up after them. So there's no time for partying. You can have fun in your job, but you have to be focused on the job. It's not going out just to have fun, and drinking on the job was a big no-no. That was something that we never tolerated, and we terminated people on the spot when we caught them. But when you're paying attention to the other 99 things on your checklist, you know for sure there's somebody out there misbehaving. And you just have to balance it. You can't be everywhere at once. And having good people was the solution. People who really gave a darn. And they're not easy to come by. And when you find them, you take good care of them.
Yeah.
Now that was the downside. Well, but the upside to that business was, it is crazy profitable. The nightclub business, when it's done right, you have to appreciate that you're only exciting until the next new place opens up. So you've got a very limited moment to shine. Your honeymoon is going to be pretty short. So make your money while you're there.
That's good input. So from there, you had, at what point did you start learning about exiting businesses? Because you're at this point where now you're turning companies around. You become a turnaround person, and you help turn around these nightclubs and you get this. What did you learn about the world of exiting?
Well, that was an interesting story. I was a minority owner in that chain. The majority owners were attorneys and real estate brokers. And we sold those businesses for a higher than fair market value price. Unfortunately, we sold that chain to a group of what are referred to as bust out artists. They came in with a little money down, but promised to give us an extra $1.5 million more than we thought it was worth. So being enamored with the exit price rather than the likelihood of actually collecting the balance of the debt service, we, 2 months into their ownership, stopped getting debt service payments. When the then president of the corporation and I went over to Hillsborough County to look at the clerk of the court records on the buying group, because we didn't do our due diligence on the buyers, we were focused on the dollar signs, we found out that they were embroiled in 22 simultaneous lawsuits with other restaurant groups they'd bought. They never had any intention of paying the full price. So my first lesson in exiting a business was in how not to go about doing it. It took us 8 months to get ownership back, and by then, the damage was too far gone.
Wow. I wasn't even aware that there were people who did that, and they call them bust-out businesses?
Bust-out artists. They will take artists. The business and rate it for the current assets or cash flow and pay only those immediate liabilities that they absolutely have to stay in business. Now, the mistake that this particular buying group made was declaring bankruptcy. And there's a fine line when you're in a reorganization stage and having the ability to call the shots taken away from you. A judge gets to say liquidate versus reorganize. But in our particular case, when they declared bankruptcy, the judge threw them out of bankruptcy court and decided that we should have possession back because they did not satisfy their obligations in the sale price. So it was a nuanced lesson, and the biggest takeaway was if you don't physically hold the stock certificates, you can't declare bankruptcy. It took 8 months for the judge to ask that question, where are the stock certificates? But that was a surprise that our attorney wasn't aware of.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, the best way to learn is by watching other people learn. That's the best way to learn. But sometimes we learn from the situations that we're in. So you got hit pretty hard the first time you had an exit experience. And, talk to us about the next path there. Because, I mean, what we're talking here and what I really like to do when I'm talking with entrepreneurs is hear how they learned, hear how they started, hear how the wisdom stacked on each other. And it's usually coming from areas of I had a little bit of success, had a failure, little success, failure. And then they wind up doing it for other people. So carry on with this journey. This is fascinating.
Certainly. Well, from there, when we sold the chain, my intention was to form a real estate tenant representation group with the president of that corporation, the gentleman I mentioned. We drove over to Tampa together and went through Microfinch. And our little leasing company was helping regional and national restaurant groups come into the Central Florida marketplace and find locations. So the term was tenant representation, but we were leasing agents working on the tenant side rather than the landlord side. We did a number of different regional chains and a couple national chains that came into Central Florida, and it was always fun and exciting. And this was taking me back to standing on street corners doing traffic counts, why this is a great location, analyzing what is a fair market rent and matching it up against the right business for that venue. It wasn't just that, well, this is a $20 per square foot lease. This one's a $30. You should take the $20 one. Not if you think on a $30 one, you're going to do the revenue to justify that location. So that was the fun part about dealing with national restaurant chains coming into Central Florida, which back in the early 90s, there were a lot of. The other side of that was it was not easy to go out and find these national chains coming into Central Florida. We had to go out and find them, court them to come in and show them these are the hot markets and why you need to be here. Now, since then, Central Florida has been recognized internationally as the best place to open up a franchised restaurant. So that was a natural back then. But I did that for about 3 years when an attorney friend of mine suggested that with my accounting background, I may be able to better serve my clients if I were selling companies, going concerns, specifically bars and restaurants, something that I had a deep knowledge of, understood why a certain location is better than another, and the ability to look at a business critically and figure out where I would benchmark it to price it for a sale. And I looked around for about 3 months. I talked to all six business brokerage houses that existed back then in 1993, asked every single one of the brokers, how does one get into business brokerage from commercial leasing? And five of the six said, well, if you don't know, why would I hire you? The sixth person said, I'm glad you asked. And his name was Dick Reed. His company was Corporate Investment. And he asked me to follow him out into the hallway of his office. He picked up a three-ring binder. And on the spine, handwritten, it said 30 days to business brokerage success. And it was a lot of articles that he put together. It was literature from Fortune magazine, from a number of different sources, but it was really about get out there and talk to business owners. And you got to walk up and down. Back then, it was the Altamont Mall. And I literally go up and down the halls of the Altamont Mall, stop in and ask, is the business owner, and this was before everything was franchised, and ask the business owner, have you thought about selling? If you did, when would you? A year from now? 2 years from now? And if you talk to enough of them, some are going to say, yes, they've thought about it. I learned that you don't talk to a business owner on Monday morning when they're excited about their week. You wait until about 6 o'clock on a Friday night. Then you ask them if they're ready to sell, and they're much more likely to say, oh yeah, that would be a good time.
That's great input. So really good insight from a friend who knew you and knew your business. He said, you know, maybe you should look at helping, you know, acquire companies, helping, you know, these, cause you have a great knowledge about this and you did that. So you started in as a broker, and I'm sure you've learned incredible amount of things over the last 25 years. Now let's get into some of the nitty gritty that, when it comes to selling a business, right? So people who are listening, let's just say you're having that conversation with them today, right? Are you thinking about one day buying and selling your business? Just like you were used to walk down the halls of Altamont Mall, now you're having a conversation via podcast to Orlando and to a lot of business owners. So that conversation happens now. Talk to us about some of the details of selling your business. So you're talking to them and you say, are you interested in selling your business? And they go, yes. What happens next, George?
The time to start thinking about selling your business is day one. If you're looking at it from a buyer's perspective, you're much more likely to pay attention to the little things that make a business more sellable. With my restaurant managers, I used to tell them, when you walk in the front door, don't do it as a restaurant manager, do it as a customer. You're going to notice things that you wouldn't notice from having been inside the four walls day in and day out, if you make it a point to look at it with fresh eyes every single day. And that goes back to thinking strategically, not tactically. Don't be so focused on that next sale or the business process or getting the throughput and workout. Step back every once in a while. And Winston Churchill says, however beautiful a strategy, you have to occasionally look at the results. And so many business owners don't look at their business and ask themselves, why are we doing this in this particular fashion? And if I were a buyer coming in looking at this company, does that make sense? So every business owner should be thinking about, one day I do want something else. And you can only get out of business in one of four fashions. You can die at your desk, you can liquidate the business, you can either sell it to somebody you already know, or sell it to somebody you don't know. Those are the only four options anyone has with that money, that equity that they have tied up in their small business. And most business owners don't take the time 10 years before an exit and ask themselves, how do I want to go about it? Now, statistically, 80% of the transactions are going to happen because a buyer sees a business owner and wants to be that person, wants to replace that person in owning that company, and will actually make the overture, sell me your business. Now, the other 20% are when the seller decides that I've done everything I wanted to accomplish with this particular business. Now I want to go and do something else with the equity I have tied up in this business. And that's that third party exit. Now the seller is not dealing with a buyer. The seller has the advantage and the opportunity of dealing with all of the potential buyers who are in the market for that kind of business during that window that he's ready to make his exit. And statistically, some of those third party buyers are going to have a lower perceived risk that the future is bright for that company. And because their risk perception is lower, they can justify paying a higher price. And what I do is help the business owner strategize for when is the right time. We do a little bit of analysis financially. What would you realize if we pulled the trigger today? And then we look at what are you doing that you could be doing better. So when we do decide to go out and start talking to buyers, we're removing that shroud, that opaque mystery for what makes this business tick. When we can make it more transparent, the buyer's perceived risk goes down. And when that happens, their ability to justify a higher multiple of cash flow goes up.
Okay, so a lot of topics, a lot of great things shared there. Talk to us about, so a few things that I have a question for is, how do you determine the value? And talk to us about what a multiplier is.
Very simple. A buyer is buying a business because he wants to receive the future economic benefit that business is going to generate for him. He's going to trade his cash today. He's going to take his money out of his retirement fund. He's going to take out his equity from property, and he's going to give it to a seller who's going away with that money. In that exchange, he's hoping to get a business, and a business is nothing more than a collection of relationships between parties, written agreements sometimes, contracts between parties, whether it's employer, employees, whether it's supplier and customer, whether it's the company's suppliers and those arrangements they have. So a business is really just a system of various agreements designed to efficiently turn work effort into future cash flow. When you've got a buyer who's taking that risk with his cash, trying to get that system, which has a high likelihood of generating that future cash flow, two things are he's going to look at, two factors. How much cash flow am I going to get? And how likely am I to get it? And if I could answer both of those questions simultaneously, I can put a value on it. Now, each buyer has their own unique value perception. If I tell you that, Josh, I'm going to give you $1,000 every year for the next 100 years. Now, how much money are you going to give me for that promise? Well, first you're going to look at me and you're going to size me up and you're going to make sure, do I have the ability to give you $1,000 financially? Am I sound enough financially that you can bank on my promise? If the answer is yes, well, you're probably going to take 5% or 4% or a 3% discount rate. And you're going to say, well, for year one, I'm going to give you $950 because that's money in the bank a year from now. Year number two, I'm going to take another discount on that across two periods. And then we're going to net it back to present value. Now, a very simple way to do that math is to, instead of talking about a discount rate and reverse engineering back to net present value, we can talk in terms of a multiple. If we know that that discount rate of 5%, if it's going on into perpetuity, is going to relate to, let's say, a multiple of 20. For a 5% discount, 5 goes into 100 20 times, that's a multiple of 20. For a 10% discount, 10 goes into 110 times. Now, businesses typically go in a range of between 20% on the low end, return on investment required by a buyer, and 50% on a high end. So if I gave that, go ahead and invert that, put a 1 over it and count how many times it goes into, and 20 discount rate is a 5 multiplier. A 50 discount rate is a 2 multiplier. So we call that discount rate capitalization of future earnings. So if, very simple, a business ought to trade for something between 2 times cash flow and 5 times cash flow. Now, cash flow is that earnings figure, but there's certain things that we have to do to get that earnings figure back to be able to compare it across different companies. Now, my expenses are unique to me based on what my CPA thinks I can get away with when I do my tax returns. I'm going to put everything in the kitchen sink until my CPA says, that's risky. You don't want to get an audit. So I'm going to put a lot of discretionary expenses in there up to a limit to where my risk tolerance that I'm comfortable, if I get an audit, I'll be okay. Now, small business owners have different comfort levels with, and different, some guys are doing this themselves and are just waiting, rolling the dice, waiting for that audit. So what a business broker has to do is undo all that tax management in their expenses by pulling out all of those discretionary expenses and just looking at, if I only put through this company those operating expenses necessary to operate the business, and I don't take a salary, how much cash flow does that business generate for a future buyer? And let's use $100,000 as the typical example. Let's say the business is grossing 500, it nets 100. So that $100,000, what we call discretionary earnings, because I decide I don't want to take a salary. If I chose to take a salary of 50,000, then my net income is only 50,000. So now I'm going to take my salary of 50 and my net income of 50. I've still got the 100. So we're undoing all the tax planning, getting back to what is that discretionary earnings figure. Then instead of going out to every single buyer and saying, what would you give me for this $100,000? We go to a database of other companies inside that same SIC code. That's a term, standard industry code classification. So if I tell you 5812, that's the SIC code for restaurants. 5813 is the SIC code for bars. Now I can go and I can take, I want to look up all of the 5812 SICs that transacted for the last 5 years in the state of Florida. I am going to go to a database of sold businesses and look at what is that central tendency. So I'll take the data, I'll put it into a graph, I'll make a histogram out of it. I'll see there seems to be a high central tendency at around 1.5 times discretionary earnings. Now that doesn't mean that particular company should sell for 1.5 times. Now I've got to go and look at, okay, what's happening inside that business? Are things improving? Are things declining? Are they growing rapidly at with what the market is growing, or are they growing at twice that rate? So all of a sudden, if now I've got a super overachieving subject company, I'm not going to give it an average 1.5. I might give it a 2. If I've got an underperforming company, I might give it a 1.
Yeah, I'm like taking as many notes as I can. This is, these kind of things have never been explained in college courses and at least the college courses that I went through. And I think that this is a great way to look, because if you're thinking, and you said this, if you're thinking with the exit in mind, the first time to think about selling your business is the day you build your business, right? You could almost reverse engineer backwards what you want your exit to be and start working towards that. Is that right?
We do that with business owners. I have a fantastic client who bought his company about 10 years ago. That's now 11 years. I know that because he just retired his 10-year SBA, Small Business Administration, note that he used to buy the business. So he got a wonderful goose in what he's actually taking home. He has no more debt service on it, but he and I sit down every 6 months and look at some of the key processes that make him as successful as he is. And we talk about ways that he can get himself out of some of the processes that are limiting his growth. For example, he is his own best salesman. He closes about 90% of the customers he talks to. His problem is he can only talk to so many customers in a 5-day work week. So he and I talk about, if you bring in two salespeople and you're number one, let's say they're not as effective at converting a lead into a transaction. Let's say they are only 50% effective at converting a lead into a closing. But if you've got two guys doing that, now you've got, instead of 90% conversion, you've got 100% conversion if you can get those guys as many leads as you had. And he says, well, now I've got two salaries and I'm only going up 10% in sales. I said, well, now that you're no longer the bottleneck in revenues, your job becomes improving that sales funnel. Go out and figure out ways to increase the number of leads that your employees have the opportunity to convert. And if you can dump more potential customers into that funnel, as these guys improve, they're no longer closing at 50%. A year from now, they're each doing 75%. That's 150% more. That's actually a 66% increase in your revenue. You can more than offset those two salaries. And now you've got a standardized presentation of the customers that's scalable. And it's not about you as the owner. And remember, when somebody wants to buy your business, you as the owner are the missing element. You're going away. So there's no value if you're gone for generating sales. So that's one of the key focuses is you're in professional service companies and hospitals. We call that your catchment mechanism. How do you get patients to want to do business with you? And I got news for you. If it's being number one Google rank, I can definitely go out and spend a lot less money on SEO ranking and get number one on Google than it would cost me to buy your business. If that is your claim to fame, you don't have an asset to sell. I'm going to go and take your market away from you just by spending more on SEO. So first off, understand what processes are working and why you're limiting yourself by doing certain things yourself. Fire yourself as your own salesperson. Put a system to where, like when I was a busboy, I had to train 3 classes of busboys before I was able to become a server. When I was the lead server, I had to train 3 classes of servers before I was allowed to move into the bar positions. That's organizational development, but it's scalability is what you're going after.
Because ultimately that makes your company more valuable, because if the company depends on the CEO, then it's not really a business, or it's not a business that can be bought and duplicated, because the CEO, it depends on the CEO. Is that right?
That's right. A buyer is not buying your time. He's buying the system in place that you've developed to turn opportunities into future cash flow.
Awesome. So for the entrepreneurs out there who are building businesses and growing businesses, what are some other components? So you talk about processes, you talk about the scalability, you talk about finding good people and investing in good people. What other things should people look at to increase the valuation of their company?
If we are thinking strategically instead of tactically, take a step back from the day-to-day operations of your business and ask yourself, why do your customers want to do business with you? And I like the line from the movie Bagger Vance, where Bagger says to Captain Juna, you've got to see the field. And if you can figure out where you are in your marketplace and understand what makes you unique, you can differentiate yourself. One thing I like to tell my clients is, even if you're selling a service business, try to focus on making it a more tangible deliverable, something that's concrete and a product, even if it's a service. And I draw the analogies to right now there's somebody walking up an aisle at a Home Depot looking for a drill bit. This person does not want a drill bit to put in their toolbox. This person is looking for the hole that that drill bit's going to make to put a peephole in their front door. But take an extension on that even further. They don't want the peephole in their front door. They want the safety and security that that peephole is going to provide their family when they're out of the house. Their loved ones don't have to open the door and potentially put themselves at risk, right, to find out who's on the other side. So if you're making drill bits and selling them, you're not just selling drill bits. You've got to tie it back into what are my customers really trying to accomplish and how do I make that more real for them? When you can tie those two together and give that deliverable to the customer and tell them this is what you're going to get for it, now you've got something that you're going to increase your bandwidth. You're going to talk to more people because they're, you know exactly who you're talking to and why. The book Built to Sell by John Warillo, written in 2010, is a fantastic book. It's a quick read. And his protagonist was developing websites, and he was frustrated that he was stuck at that $2 million a year in revenue run. And he was trying to be all things to his few clients in New York City when he stepped back and asked himself, what do we do better than all of our competitors? And he realized it was helping customers take an abstract logo, recognize that certain shapes are associated with different businesses and color schemes say different things. And he, through heuristics, was able to develop an algorithm to where a customer could go onto his website and design their own logo. And then if they needed the finishing touches put on it, he had the expertise in-house to finish it up for them and explain, this is why this color says that. You don't want this. You want to put this above there. This is going to emote this expression to your customer base. When he did that, he wasn't selling to people in New York City, all web services. He was selling to everybody around the world, logo design, and an automated, repeatable deliverable. He scaled from his $2 million trap he was in to a $20 million company and sold because he didn't have to be there. His employees knew everything to do without him. He didn't have to sell. It was automatic. His business ran without him, and that's the ideal. And when you understand what makes you unique and you do that more, better, and perfect it, people are going to come to you and your market increases exponentially.
Yeah. So the more, especially the more people who are interested in buying your company through, you know, supply and demand, that would increase your price too, right? What are some ways? And I definitely want to ask a few more questions if you have the time. I know we're wrapping up our time, but I've got a few more questions if you're open to it.
Absolutely.
All right. Cool. Thank you. So what are a few more? What are a few more ways where people can? If they're interested in selling or thinking about selling, even in the next 10 years, you know, so they should definitely come talk with you. What are some of the ways that you're going to work with them to help them boost the value and to help them plan for the coming exit?
Well, one thing I would like to suggest is not just thinking about their business as their retirement plan. Successful, safe, smart retirement planning isn't one day I'm going to sell my business and that's the vehicle that's going to take me off into the sunset. If you have that successful business, which if you're doing $800,000 plus, you're more than covering your bills. You've got discretionary cash flow that you could be buying vacation homes with, or you could be funding your retirement plan. And if you're not conservative enough to have alternative plans for what happens if the industry I'm in goes south, then you will be one day on the short end wondering, what now? My business won't get me enough money to do what I need to do. If we have another housing bubble burst that we did back in 2006, 7, and 8, all those business owners had no exit. They all had to say, well, maybe 2010's my year, maybe 2013. Now those people are coming up on their exit years and now they're pulling the trigger. And buyers are stepping back and saying, well, how many more years do we have in this continued long economic boom cycle? So the multiples are in question. Smart money says, now is a pretty good time to think about exiting. But it depends if you're old enough and if you're going to have enough out of that business to do what your next plan is. So I like to tell people, go ahead and have multiple irons in the fire to make sure you're secure. I've got fantastic friends who are financial planners, and they save people's lives financially. They really do. When it comes down to how I can help somebody get their business to the market, expose it to more potential buyers in order to realize the highest price for their business, they've done all the heavy lifting. They've built the company. My job is to now make that company transparent so a buyer can figure out, this is what I'll get in the future if I buy it. And because I see the seller's got all these systems in place that now that he's gone, when a customer throws a wrench in the works, I've got people that have some institutional knowledge and have made those hard calls in the past. I'm not the guy who's going to get stuck holding the bag. And that buyer is going to pay you an extra multiple. That person is confident that that business will survive that transition and continue to grow. That's what I can do. I can take and peel back the layers of the onion so the buyer who hasn't even come down to Florida yet can understand, if I buy this business, this is what I'm going to have to do. This is what the seller's currently doing. And he's got this person who does administrative. He's got this person who does the accounting. This person does the sales. So my job is going to be to step in and keep the momentum going.
Awesome. So you've been doing this for 25 years and you've seen a lot of business exits. You've seen a lot of transactions happen. You've seen a lot of, you've seen a lot through recessions and through really great times too. If you had three pieces of golden advice for an entrepreneur out there, I know I've been asking you tons of questions and asking you a bunch, but if you had three pieces of advice for an entrepreneur out there, what would they be? And maybe what we could do is someone who's looking to start a business, someone in the middle of business, and then maybe someone who's at the end of business. So one question for each of them. What advice do you have for the early stage person? I'm thinking about starting a business.
Understand what it is that you do better than anyone else. Figure out if there is a market for it. Just because you like it does not mean it's sellable. If you recognize that there's a demand that's not being met, entrepreneurs figure out creative ways to solve other people's problems and they take a small profit for it. Now, if you've got that skill set and you see that there's a real need, go get it. Jump in with both feet and don't take anyone else's advice, because everyone else is going to tell you, don't do it. And those guys that say, to hell with that. Now, a lot of times they're going to stumble. A lot of times they're going to be frustrated. Sometimes they're going to be late on mortgage payments. But those guys who gut it out and get past that $800,000 survival mode, once they get that business to the point that now they can take $250,000 out of it every year, they've got a choice. Now, do I want to stay in that 800 to million five revenue band and make between 200 and 400,000 a year and be fat, dumb, and happy and successful? And that's the millionaire next door. That's the person who's making $250,000 a year and only spending 120 of it. That's the person who 20 years from now, I want to talk to. That's that successful business owner. Now, there's going to be some people who aren't satisfied with that $1.5 million revenue business. They want it all. They want to take it and they want to be the best at their craft. Now, between $1.25 million and $2.5 million, that is the danger zone. For example, a client I was talking to, this was way back in 97. I remember it vividly. I'm looking at his financials and I say, Dan, you were doing $1.5 million here 3 years ago and now you're back down to 800,000. And what happened? What if we go and show this to a buyer, the buyer's going to say, there's a real issue here. He's shrinking. he's probably only going to do 600,000 next year. And Dan said, well, I'll tell you, George, I was chasing growth. I brought in a general manager for my plant, and I was out there selling, and that's what I'm good at. So as I was coming back from a sales presentation, I remember looking over and seeing a job site that we had a sign going up on Saturday, and this was only Wednesday. And I was wondering, how much does that crane sitting on that job site cost per day, knowing that I'm paying rent on it for an extra 3 days? So I kind of accelerated, put my foot on it to get back to the shop, and I asked my plant manager, why are we paying $400 a day for a crane that we can't use for another 4 days? He said, well, I didn't think it would be available, so I had to rent it now. And Dan said, so I fired him, and I was madder than a hornet, and I was making more money at $1 million than I ever made at $1.5 million. And most small business owners are going to be in that. If you want to get from that $1.25 million to the $2.5 million range, they have to start bringing in some additional management talent. They've got to start delegating a lot of these decisions. And these people are going to go through a learning curve and make some mistakes. It's a natural part of growth. It hurts. It's painful. It's costly. And it takes a certain individual who can look at the big picture and be strategic and decide, once we get through these learning curve pains, we'll be able to really take off. Now, once a company is up in that $2.5 million range and they've got that deep management bench, and they now they're on the radar screen for the real players, those middle market companies doing $50 million. Those middle market companies, the platforms doing $50 to $100 million, see that this little guy doing $2.5 million, $5 million, $10 million is growing at my expense. He's only growing because he's able to eat away at my market share. We got to go and stop him. We got to get back in there and fight him in the marketplace. And now you're off to the races. Now, those are the companies that get snapped up by private equity groups. When you got $10 million in revenue, you've got $1 million or $2 million in a, instead of discretionary earnings in that league, we refer to it as EBITDA. And that just means that after all salaries are paid, it's discretionary earnings after paying the salaries. So now we've got that company that is a target. He's a target because he's getting into the pocket of the big boys, or the big boys could buy him. And that's what investment bankers do. They help those $20 million businesses get gobbled up by the $100 million businesses. And those guys have the bandwidth to do everything they need to do. I want to focus on those guys in that 800,000 to 5 million range who are big enough but don't want to take it to C. They're taking it from A to B. They want somebody else to figure out, okay, how do you get it to C?
Awesome. So yeah, you hit points at every single part of that business growth. You gave really good input on this. So let's just say there's a business out there, and the business owner, you know, in Orlando or really anywhere, and they want to have a conversation with you. How can people find you and contact you?
My website is pretty self-explanatory, businessforsaleflorida.net. And if you log in there, you're going to see we have over 3,000 companies currently on the market. Buyers are going there and looking for businesses and emailing me 4 and 5 a day, inquiries about some of the businesses we have for sale. So if somebody wants to reach out and contact me, most of my clients come to me through financial planners, CPAs, past clients and successful business owners. And a few come to me through Google, but I don't spend any money on AdWords or that kind of stuff. I like to work with those guys that I can help. And I only take about half of the companies to market that we sit down and go through the consideration for what would you realize if you sell. And I put in a couple of hours in the financial analysis with no requirement that they do anything other than let's look at it realistically. And if it's the right time, we'll pull the trigger. If it's not, we'll check back every 6 months and figure out when is the right time. So I've got a cadre of business owners that when they're ready, we're ready to go.
That's great. So, and we'll put that on, put your link in the show notes. George, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your knowledge, explaining to me how multiples have been determined and how that works and how businesses are evaluated and the four ways to get out of your business. Man, I wrote down a ton of notes while we were talking, and man, I just appreciate your knowledge, your wisdom, and just for sharing your experience with the community out there. Ladies and gentlemen in the audience, if you are building a business and this idea comes in your head that you'd like to, you know, buy in or sell a business in the near future, I just encourage you to go to the show notes, click on it, and have a conversation with George, and you know, let him know that you found him on the Orlando Entrepreneur Show, and that you know, Josh says hi, and I'd love for you to meet my friend George. So, George, thanks for coming on the show, man. Really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for all these notes that I'm going to go digest.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Josh. Thank you for having me on, and you do a great job for your audience.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you, guys. And I wouldn't have an audience without my audience. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening into the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. We will talk with you on the next episode. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.